Mrs. Hewson? The next matter is Amon versus Hewson. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
If it pleases the court, Judge Moore, Judge Inbody, and Judge Poole. This case presents a really simple question. Does a released defendant in a medical malpractice case get a line on a verdict form with no expert testimony against him? No 702, Schaefer'sman qualified expert testified against the RNA in this case, yet she got a line on the verdict form. And we live in a world where I have to have some very specific things to prove my five elements every time. I got to prove the physician-patient relationship, prove what the standard is, I got to prove breach, I got to prove causation and nature and extended damages. I have to do that, required by many, many cases in this state, by competent expert testimony who's qualified, has enough facts, uses reliable methodologies of analysis, applies those appropriately to the facts, and reaches a logical conclusion. We had three experts testify at the trial. Mine, the defendants, and the defendant himself. Not one of those people ever said anything directly against the CRNA that she violated or any of the standard of care, because no one offered any proof of it. So,
when you went into trial, you were still trying the case on the original complaint that had been filed, is that correct?
Yes.
That was the operative pleading going in, even though you had reached a financial settlement about a week before and had released the anesthetist from the proceeding, correct?
I think all I'm allowed to say is I reached a settlement.
All right, you reached a settlement, but she was a released party, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Whereas the hospital had been released about a year before.
So
your operative pleading still made allegations against both the doctor and the anesthetist. Is that correct? And in fact, Dr. Lanzafame, is it Lanzafame? Who was your expert?
Yes, sir.
Offered some opinions at trial that were critical of the anesthetist, did he not?
I don't think so. I know what you're talking about, but I don't call those qualified opinions.
Well,
made a statement.
I believe it was your own questioning of the doctor, asked him if he would have expected, as a surgeon, that the anesthetist would convey to him a drop in the CO2 levels.
I agree.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And that he was critical in this case that the anesthetist had not done that.
Okay.
I mean, is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the magic words were not asked of him, or maybe they were, and he said, I'm not qualified to say she breached the standard of care. But he still said, I would have expected my anesthetist to alert me if the CO2 levels were dropping. And that did not happen in this case.
Right.
Okay. So given that you tried the case on the operative complaint, that you were still at least coming into the trial making allegations that the anesthetist at least had some contributing cause to the injury and death of the decedent, how is it that the court couldn't have submitted that issue to the jury? Also in light of the fact that the defendant, Dr., and help me with this, is Nagengast?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That he also was still asserting that there were third parties over who he had no control that caused the injury and death here.
So I disagree with that to a certain extent, Your Honor. Everything you said is true. However, if that's the case, would I have been able to use that evidence to withstand a motion for summary judgment against me if I was presenting that evidence against the CRNA? I don't have any witness saying that they're qualified. Matter of fact, Dr. Lanzafame, through the defense counsel, actually took himself out of the ability to be able to do that, because when he was cross-examined, he said, I'm not qualified, I'm not giving an opinion on standard of care, I'm not giving an opinion on breach, and I'm not going to give an opinion on causation on anything that the anesthetist did. So the fact that he makes a comment later on is, it would have been nice to know Is that enough to withstand a motion for summary judgment or a directed verdict? I don't think so.
Wasn't it your job to either file an amended complaint prior to trial where you only focused on the negligence of the surgeon, or shouldn't you have filed some type of a motion in limine prior to trial?
What would the motion in limine have said, sir?
That the anesthetist is gone, and so that the only issue here is the negligence of the surgeon.
I think we did that. I'm pretty sure that that was the discussion we had with the trial court. And as far as the operative complaint, the evidence has to control what the jury instructions are, not the complaint. And there was no competent evidence delivered against the CRNA. And Dr. Nagengast said, I'm not blaming anybody. He didn't offer anything. Dr. Fitzke didn't offer anything. And Dr. Lanzafame, I think, excluded himself from being able to do that. I get your point. But the problem is how do we flip that over? Can we use that testimony to withstand a motion for a directed verdict? I mean, if I was down here saying I had enough evidence because my man who says he's not qualified then says, you know, it would have been nice to know, would you have ever sustained that? And I just don't see how that ever gets to the point of getting a line on a jury form. You got to have that evidence. It's got to come in the way that the court says it does.
I'm gonna ask you to help me here because I've tried to review the record.
Yes, sir.
And I saw Mr. Tannehill's motion in limine prior to trial. Are you telling me you specifically recall filing a motion in limine to prevent the defense from pointing any fingers at the settling party, the anesthetist, before the trial started?
We had 97 motions in limine, Your Honor. I don't remember specifically, but I don't think we did. If we did, I don't know. I just can't say that. However, think about the concept of how do you present that to the jury with no evidence? I mean, there wasn't any evidence that would have met the Schaefer's-Man requirements. I mean, Dr. Lanzafame has removed himself from being able to say anything about that that's admissible evidence. And so he makes a comment kind of at the end of his testimony that would have been nice to know. And yes, it would have been nice to know. But since it's nice to know enough to get someone a line on a jury form or to keep from a summary judgment or a directed verdict?
Let me ask you this. Had the jury gotten to verdict form 2 or 3, I might be a little more inclined to lean your way.
Yes, sir.
But the fact that they filled out verdict form 1, which indicated that you had not met your burden of proof as to Dr. Nagengast. So how are you prejudiced by the fact that comparative fault was part of the jury instructions, but yet it doesn't seem the jury ever got there?
How do we know? I mean, that's just speculating. Well,
but they're finding that you didn't prove negligence of the doctor.
Right, but let's talk about inherent confusion when you get it. So a jury hears a week-long trial, and then right at the very end, they get handed a verdict form with a line for someone they heard no competent testimony. And how is that not inherently confusing? Just all of a sudden show up and have a verdict form.
Counsel, I want to go back to something that you said. I'm having a problem seeing the whole picture, so I need a little help here.
Yes, sir.
When you say that you couldn't withstand a motion for a directed verdict, who would make the motion for directed verdict?
Let's say that I'm flipping the evidence around and using it for different things. Let's say that I was going to present the evidence that it would have been nice to know. That was my presentation, and I was going to use that to keep the case going against the CRNA.
That's CRNA all. Is it not a member? It's not there. They can't make a motion. Who's going to make the motion for a directed verdict?
I'm not explaining myself very well, Your Honor. All I'm saying is I'm not saying in this case, but I'm just saying.
Let's say this case. In this case,
yes,
there was evidence presented of the negligence of the CRNA. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. But what was the evidence?
Well, I believe Judge Pirtle went through and talked about it. Okay. I believe also that the surgeon indicated that during the testimony that there was information that if he would have had, he would have done things differently. So the question to me comes down, and not so much as to whether or not the second, the third, second and third instructions should have been given, second number two and number four, 24, I guess, but number two that talks about the, if you go with the verdict form number one as opposed to verdict form number two or three. But whether or not there should have been an instruction that specifically sets out that if you find that either of these parties were negligent, then you have to decide the percent of each of them. Because obviously your client wasn't negligent. There was no contributory negligence to this.
So apportionment requires two parties still be alive, and that's after the determination of liability. So the predicate question is, did you have, is that enough evidence? What was said to get to the end of the case?
And so it's either, apparently the judge thought there was sufficient evidence.
Obviously.
Because he gave the instruction.
He explained himself well.
And the defendant isn't going to object because they want to make sure that the jury thinks that the other party was responsible. So I'm having trouble seeing where you were harmed by not having a motion for directed verdict or a summary dismissal of some sort of file.
I'm sorry I didn't explain myself well enough on that point. Any other questions?
Yeah, before you go, there was no allegation of comparative contributory negligence on the part of the decedent or anybody connected to the decedent, correct?
No, sir. She was under it.
Okay. So we have 21185.09.
Yes, sir.
21-85-10 and 21-85-11.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So because there was no contributory allegations on the decedent, I don't believe 09 applies.
Yes,
I don't believe 10 applies. If 11 applies, did the judge follow the law correctly?
I only wrote down 10, so I don't remember what 11 was, but the point was I believe that part requires that apportionment after proof of liability. So the big question is, was there enough evidence out there to find her liable?
Her being?
The CRNA.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further?
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Bill Tannehill, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees, Stephen Nagengast, MD, and General Surgery Associates. As you know, this was a medical malpractice case that was tried in Odo County in front of Judge Funk. There was a unanimous defense verdict, and I'm here to ask the court to affirm that verdict because I think the judge, as a whole, instructed the jury the way they were to be instructed, and I believe that there was no prejudice by the instruction that Mr. Garland is complaining about, nor the verdict form that he's complaining about, because the jury never reached those, and so there was no prejudice.
Do you think it was proper for the court to give the instruction on apportionment?
I do, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Well, the reason I say that, Mr. Garland has actually raised some issues that I didn't have an opportunity to brief because they weren't raised either at the trial court level and they weren't raised in his opening brief. But he seems to be suggesting that because no contributory negligence was pled, that there's no entitlement to an apportionment instruction.
Contributory negligence meaning against the plaintiff, him, herself,
or
against any other defendants?
I think what he's saying is contributory negligence against the plaintiff or the decedent herself. And that is inconsistent. If you look through the Nebraska jury instructions that Professor Fenner put the draft together, and the Supreme Court Committee on Rules and Practice has looked at those instructions. And if you go through and you look specifically at instruction 2.01A, and then the corresponding verdict form 5.02, and if you look through in the comments of the Nebraska jury instructions, second edition, specifically pages 449 to 452, It's practically as if they wrote the brief for me on that issue. I mean, they go through the legislative history, and they look at how the LBs were specifically changed to devise the language, civil actions to which contributory negligence may be pursuant to law, a defense. That's point, that's 2521.185.07. And they go through the legislative history, and what they try and discuss is that there's four possible different interpretations that could have been made under the way that the LB was first drafted, so that's clarified, and the floor debates among the legislators show that what they wanted was for this to apply to every cause of action based on a tort to which contributory negligence is allowed in a generic sense, without regard to whether contributory negligence is properly in the case at bar. And the committee that drafted the jury instructions that were used in this case, they agreed with that. And they, in the comments, they say how that's the majority rule in other jurisdictions. That's the only way that that statutory scheme makes sense.
So look, let's come back to
Yes.
So his position is, in order to have submitted her negligence to the jury, it was up to you to put on expert testimony that she had breached the standard of care.
I understand he's saying that today, but I can rely on any evidence put on by anyone in the courtroom. And Dr. Lonsenfame's deposition was already videotaped. It was already prepared, and it was presented to the jury. And he talked about the communications that should take place between a surgeon and an anesthetist. And he gave specific examples of back when he was still allowed to practice, when he still had privileges to practice, and he had an instance of an air embolism, and the anesthetist picked up the changes on the monitors and communicated to him. That was his expectation. He also testified that it was his expectation that they would have some fundamental basic knowledge about physiology and medicine. I mean, he specifically says that she should have known of certain changes that were taking place on the monitor to communicate that to the physician. And had it been communicated, that would have been information that the surgeon then could have used to do something sooner. He specifically said that he thought that there was a misdiagnosis, and he attributed that not only to the CRNA but to Dr. Nagin. Yes. He was commenting on standard of care. He was commenting on what he expected to be done. He was commenting on the practice involving communication and notification between CRNAs and surgeons. Mr. Garland can't put that evidence on and then complain about the sufficiency of it. I'm entitled to take advantage of any evidence that there is.
So, counsel, do you think that there was sufficient evidence to raise a jury question as to whether or not the CRNA was negligent her actions actually were approximately caused or contributed to the problem, to the injury, the damage, the death?
I would have argued against it had I been her attorney, and I think I would have probably come up short on that. I think that the judge would have probably said that evidence came in, it wasn't objected to. Mr. Tannehill, you didn't move to strike it. They heard that. They're allowed to consider that. It's before them. Plus, I think this case is outside of that context. I think that the comparative negligence statutes are designed to give defendants the right to an allocation. If there is any evidence whatsoever, I think we're entitled to the right to an allocation. The statute says that there shall be an allocation if there's a settling co-defendant, and the jury shall determine what their allocation or what their percentage of fault is.
Could the jury have come back and said 100% to the doctor under the other alternate jury form or verdict forms?
Certainly. They could have allocated everything against Dr. Nagin-Guess and nothing against the CRNA. They were entitled, I mean, jury instruction number 25 that Judge Funk gave was the absolute right instruction to give under this circumstance. any right to joint and several liability, that had been forfeited when the settlement was made. That right is forfeited. I mean, the common law in Nebraska on joint and several liability was abrogated when this series of statutes was passed. The plaintiff forfeited that right, and they no longer had the right to get an instruction that said they can recover everything against Dr. Nagengas, even if both of them were negligent. Instead, Judge Funk did exactly what he was supposed to do. He gave an instruction that said, you're to allocate between these two, and you can allocate however you want, and that's going to affect the damages that are awarded.
But didn't he do it by saying you first have to find that the doctor was negligent?
Exactly. That was the threshold hurdle. At first, they had to find that the doctor, Dr. Nagengas, was negligent before ever even getting to this issue, and they never got to it.
Right. And I believe there was testimony from your client that he was in charge of the surgery. I mean, he was the man, and he had these other people that were helping him.
He testified that he was the surgeon, and he was in charge of the surgical aspect. I mean, he wouldn't have been in charge of the anesthesia aspect. He's not an anesthetist and doesn't do that, but he is in charge of the surgery. He was the one that was insufflating the patient. He was the one that was in charge of putting the CO2 into the patient. But there was never any dispute in this case that this patient did indeed have a venous air embolism. It's the type of rare risk that's inherent in this procedure. And he wasn't being blamed for causing it. He was being blamed for once the CRNA told him that there had been a problem and the patient was coding, should he have then put the patient into this special position called the Durant's position? That's what he was being blamed for, and so that's why this communication issue was pertinent for the jury to take a look at and allocate negligence between the settling party and the surgeon if there was any negligence in that communication.
Other than Dr. Lanzafame, had Dr. Nagengast or your expert offered any other testimony that was critical of the anesthetist?
Well, Dr. Nagengast doesn't come right out and criticize anyone, but what he talks about is what the expectations are and what the trust is, having worked with this CRNA for many years and having worked with other CRNAs, and how you trust them to look at the monitors and provide information. He doesn't flat out say, I criticize anyone. He leaves that up to the jury to do that. But he says what the expectations are, how the surgeon and this nurse anesthetist work together based upon all of his years of experience.
And so the only, as far as your client, the only issue that went to the jury was whether or not he had failed to meet the standard of care for not reacting and placing the patient in a certain position after he was communicated the information about the CO2 level. Is that correct?
That was the only issue. It was a very narrow issue.
Counsel, are you aware of the Wirt versus Kolbeck case?
Versus Kolbeck.
It's a 2007 case. And what it talks about is that where the evidence is sufficient to raise a jury question as to whether a defendant's or a third party's negligence proximately caused or proximately contributed to a plaintiff's injuries, the trial court must inform the jury that the plaintiff is entitled to recover damages, if any, from the defendant, if the jury thinks the defendant is guilty of negligence, if solely or in concurrence with a third person
proximately caused or contributed to the plaintiff's injury and failure to do so is reversible error. When I read that, it gives me the impression that there should have been another jury instruction telling the jury the relationship between the parties, and if you find that either one is negligent, then you have to go to the apportionment rather than just the doctor.
Are you familiar with that? No, I disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that that instruction is actually given in the event that there is no settlement and where there may be another party that's not in the case that has some fault. You look at the potential concurrent negligence of the two, and if there is a finding against the defendant in the case, under joint and several theories, you're allowed to recover everything from the defendant in the case. But that has been forfeited. That doesn't apply under this circumstance. Here, what you have to give is an instruction that says, if you think there was negligence between the CRNA who's out of the case because of the settlement and the surgeon, what you do is you apportion. I think that the Worth case doesn't apply under this circumstance.
So do you think it's 21185.11 that is the relevant statute?
Exactly. 0.11 is what gives the defendant a right, a statutory right to an allocation if a co-defendant or a party that hasn't even been brought into the lawsuit has settled. Because otherwise the statutory scheme just doesn't make sense. Mr. Garland could settle with a whole host of defendants either before he brings the lawsuit, or he could settle with them in the lawsuit, and I would never be able to get an allocation against any of them because he takes the position that they have to still be in the case at the time it's submitted, or I'm not entitled to an allocation. And that just doesn't make sense. That the statutory scheme wouldn't work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Step back. I know we took him over. Can you tell me how far?
We've taken him over too.
We took the appellant over also. How much did we take him over? The appellee was 305 over?
Yes.
Okay, so we've actually owe Mr. Garland some time. Is that what you're saying to me?
Yes.
About a minute? All right. Mr. Garland, I'm going to give you a minute to make any response if you'd like to.
Concentrated more, I thought that we were done.
You can always wait.
Yes, sir. We can talk about the Tadros case and Maxwell case and these other things, but the bottom line is that if we're going to change the law and we're going to say we're going to give instructions to jurors on malpractice cases without meeting those Schaeferman requirements, we're changing a lot of things. We play according to a mother may I rule. We got to say it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 before we get the opinion in. So if the goal here is to relax what it takes to get an opinion in malpractice cases, I'm all for it because I need to be able to make it as easy as possible for my plaintiffs. And if I don't have to hit those Schaeferman requirements, I'm okay with it. Anything else?
Thank you.
One more thing. The Tadros case, I know that came up a lot. That was a car accident that did not require expert testimony on liability. If it had been, the result's not going to be the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Maybe excuse
me.
Thank you very much.
Matters deemed submitted. Counsel, you're excused. I appreciate you being here today. That completes this session of the Court of Appeals.